This podcast is produced by WZEN.org, the online radio station of the Mountains and Rivers Order. Tune in to WZEN.org to hear other teachings from Zen Mountain Monastery and the Zen Center of New York City, as well as a wide range of programs relevant to spiritual practice as it unfolds in the world today.
Book of Equanimity, case number 5. King Yuan and the Price of Rice. One song's introduction. Siddhartha cut off his flesh to give to his parents, yet is not listed in the legends of filial children. Devadatta pushed over a mountain to crush the Buddha, but did he fear the sound of sudden thunder? Having passed through the forest of thorns and cut down the sandalwood tree, just wait till the year ends. As of old, early spring is still cold. Where is the Buddha's body of reality? Main case. A monk asked King Yuan, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism?" King Yuan said, "What is the price of rice and luling?" Hongqi's verse. To accomplish work of great peace has no sign. The family way of the peasants is most pristine. Only concerned with village songs and festival drinking, how would they know of the virtues of Shan or the benevolence of Yao? So, in many ways, this is a very good, very rich anga. And right from the moment go, when we turned our attention to the teachings of Shantidevas, they were connected to this challenge of finding the thread of Bodhisattva Va within our own lives. It became clear that Shantideva was going to take us and to a task, and many of us kind of felt slapped around by him during these past 3 months, and many of us, some of you actually acknowledge that, want to deliberately to continue that encounter with his demand, his detailed expectation and very practical teachings of how to go about encountering ourselves in those places of our very basic humanity, and how it is that we can release ourselves from within that samsaric bubble of our illusion of self-centeredness to offer ourselves completely. I find personal great solace and companionship in Shantideva because he relieves me from the need to what I'm frequently accused to of doing, which is psychologizing the Dharma, because he does it so much deeper than anything that we were going to come up with in the 21st century, that his vision, his willingness to see the details of our dynamics, of our humanity, speaks a language which is actually very precise and very comforting and demanding in its unmitigated willingness to point precisely where, for most of us, we don't want to look. You know, the spiritual bypassing has come up as the sub-theme for the anga, the spiritual bypassing being that tendency to want to use the spirituality of trying to get around our humanity, or more specifically, the heart of our darkness, if you will. And the cure for that is Shantideva's guide to the Bodhisattva way of life. Go ahead, try to perform a spiritual bypassing by taking up each of those stanzas and finding them within the heart of our practice, the heart of our being. You know, somebody said that they got a deep appreciation during this Anga of the meaning of the jeweled mirror Samadhi, which is that central symbol within the Anga chart. After encountering themselves through Shantideva, they realize now that it's more like those pieces of fractured glass that you see at the site of a car accident, where when you look into each one, you see your face with all of those cracks across it. And she realized that that's the jeweled mirror Samadhi and the perfection that becomes available to us within those fragments, with those bits of what Shantideva is pointing to. This anga of illusion breaker. And I thought that I found the missing footnote to the Genjo Koan. Looking closely at some of the text, there is a little footnote right at the beginning where Dogen begins the statement of to study the way is to study the self, and then the equation goes from to study the self is to forget the self. In that to study the self, there is a footnote which says to study the self is to embody the each stanza of Shantideva's Gate of Bodhisattva. And to embody the each stanza of Shantideva's guideline to the Bodhisattva way of life is to forget the self. Watch out for the spiritual bypassing right there. You know, that's the beauty of teachings like that. That's the beauty of an angle like this. Because if when we go directly from to study the self is to forget the self, it's quite easy to fill that with all sorts of profound ideas. To see my perfection and everything that I do is to forget the self. How different is that to study the tension in my temples right now and the pressure of my eyebrows and the furrowing of my forehead is an indication of the judgmentality that I'm passing on the speaker at this very moment. Go there. Because then to forget the self is to ask yourself not to forget that experience that you're having, but how to forget yourself within that experience. How to find the intimacy within every single one of those details that he points to. That the dharmas advance and realize the self. Sounds so wonderful. What does that look like when that person with an angry intent approaches you and really wants to hurt you? That's the approaching of the Dharma, that its advancement. What's the realization there? What is it that we're called to do? How is it that we practice that? How is it that the samsaric bubble of our illusion needs to be addressed when we get to the details like that? What a gift. Breaking up the illusions about this world, about ourselves, about practice, about accomplishment. The amazing and the unique nature of the spiritual undertaking that the Buddha Dharma offers us, and we need to pause when we say that, is that we are most fulfilled when we are giving something up. Again, it's a strange way to put it, but that's precisely what it is that we're staking ourselves in when we enter this path. When something is being taken away, specifically, that untenable position, that solidity, that apparent solidity of that illusion. So may the spirit of this dissolution of our illusions continue well into Sunday and to the conclusion of this anga, and hopefully carries us right through beyond. It simply means to the next step of this path, to the deepening of our appreciation of what actually needs taken care of being deeply interested of where is it within us that the holding on to some idea of ourselves, some idea of practice, some idea of accomplishment, some idea of a teacher-student relationship, some idea of emptiness, still lingers on. Climbing has always been a useful metaphor for me, a reminder of the journey of the path. You know, very frequently there are seductive climbs. Climbs that look like they are very, very straightforward, either by the dynamics of the route or something quite compelling, and a crack or some very definable line on the cliff. And there are many that pull you into the process of actually moving up that crack. And as you go on, the holds become more tenuous, which actually requires you that you speed up. And the only thing that you're seeing is the chalked up marks of the people that have gone before you and that obvious route that lies ahead. And then with the increasing speed and increasing tenuousness of the things that you're trying to hold on for your security, at a certain point, it's your very motion that's starting to define the reality of this thing that you are invested yourself in. And things become faster and less secure, and faster, less insecure, until you come to that inevitable point where you peel off and with a scream start going downhill. And it's only that particular moment that you realize all those blood marks and scratches and fingernails and hair follicles and brain bits and bone bits that are descending along the route until the crash happens and you land into your death and forgetfulness. And with an amazing clarity, you bounce right back and look up and says, wow, what an amazing crack. Let me climb that again. Like samsara. Like the need to pause for an instant and maybe consider, critique, reflect on what actually is going on. What is it that I am resting on right now? Samsaric bubbles of illusion. Not sure where the hell that came up from, but sounds good. You know, it's fascinating to what degree we're able to sustain these all-inclusive, universally complete bubbles of illusion. What's amazing about it from the vantage point of practice is that we are continuously, obviously, defending and maintaining that boundary condition, which is continuously threatened actually by two things. One is obvious, and that's the other bubbles. The samsaric bubbles of illusion. But the thing that also threatened that bubble is insight into the inherent nature of emptiness of that bubble. And insight into the nature of that bubble is threatening to that. And we are amazingly astute to quickly patch up any puncture holes in that illusion. Any of those moments of selflessness, any of those moments of practice that actually allow us some manifestation of reality. As we say that we're looking for that. That's why it takes so long to recognize, to become comfortable, to create what Shantideva and Nagarjuna speak about, understanding of imprints of emptiness within your mind that may allow you to at least understand how to proceed and how to encounter the things on the way. Shantideva ends the guidebook in a plaintive tone. It's actually not the ending of the book itself, it's the ending of the ninth chapter, the chapter on wisdom, on the expression of his teaching on emptiness, his teachings on the middle way. in line with teachings of Nagarjuna, of the teachings of Madhyamika, of the foundations of what it is that we're practicing here. There is the chapter on the dedication of merit, which is glorious and in certain ways a recovery from those two stanzas that he ends with, where his tenor is both one of amazing, unlagging dedication of all of his energy and joy to this, but also a very somber and sober note of realizing what he's up against and what we are up against. He says, "When shall I be able to allay and quench the dreadful heat of suffering's blazing fires with plentiful rains of my own bliss that pour torrential from my clouds of merit? My wealth of merit gathered in with reverence, but without conceptual target, when shall I reveal this truth of emptiness to those who go to ruin through belief in real existence?" In less poetic formulation of that line, he says, "How can I teach this truth of emptiness, presenting it without conceptual target, without any specific intent that's driving it, to those who, as they hear the teachings of emptiness, reify that teachings at the very instant that they're hearing it?" Complete generosity, exhaustive turning over of his work, his accomplishment, his understanding, and at the same time that clear recognition. And then that's followed by that heartfelt, complete dedication of the merits of these teachings to touch all of the aspects of this universe, all of the beings, in the most horrific of hells to the most blissful of heavens, including all the manifestations of the Sangha, including himself. He reminds us in that ending of the monumental, truly, proportions of this task in view of that habitual, almost necessary shift of mind to continuously reify, make things and superimpose them on ourselves and this world. And yet, simultaneously, all of that ultimate capacity in each one of us to take care of it. And the rest of the guide, the importance of remembering and seeing the specificity of the problem. What is it that we need to take care of? Just as there is this beginningless reality of our enlightened nature, so there is this beginningless predisposition and expression of our ignorance that reifies this reality and sees it as substantially existing entities, the outer world, the feelings, the thoughts, and everything unfolds from there. And so the teachings are seen and heard in the same way, as existent, as definable, as fixed. Even the teachings on emptiness, even the teachings on non-existence that instantaneously becomes existent, even the teachings like King Wan's, "What is the price of rice and luling?" The ultimate illusion breaker. One song's comment is that very, very frequently people hearing that response say something to the effect of, "The price of luling cannot be assessed." And right there, already make a thing out of it. An it that cannot be grasped. The ungraspable thing. And it may seem that this naivete of our conventional reality and that tendency to make things, to see things, to perceive things as really existent may seem innocent. But it's this that Shantideva points as the suffering's blazing fires and dreadful heat. That is the totality of our suffering. That apparently naive, innocent conventionality of how we go about our life. Nothing dramatic, nothing transgressing deeply against this world. We're living a good life. We're taking care of things. And it is that shift of mind that makes things out of this life, that is the suffering's blazing fire and dreadful heat. That is really the only reason for the global warming. And what Shantideva offers, and what the Buddha Dharma offers, is those two challenges against the samsaric bubbles of illusion. Very, very much in line of what naturally presents that challenge. The otherness and the utter emptiness. Most of the teachings hinge on presenting us of seeing things in a different way. See them differently. Right there, something starts to begin. And again, Shantideva calls it the imprints of emptiness. And he says you can't hold both at the same time in your mind. You can either hold ideas, thoughts, actions, speech, which are imprints of self-centeredness, or you can cultivate imprints of emptiness, imprints of selflessness. What are they? An enso, a gassho, a bow. An imprint of emptiness is vast as a robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. I wear the Tathagata's teaching, saving all sentient beings. May this compassionate dana be extended to all beings. The imprint of emptiness is do not create evil, practice good, actualize good for others. The imprint of emptiness is the 930 stanzas of Shantideva. What we invoke makes a difference, obviously. If it didn't, we would be possibly chanting in the middle of our service, may this universe sink in the mire of ignorance, greed, and anger. We don't. Because it matters. Act based on virtues. Practice the paramitas. Offer kind words. Invoke feelings of loving kindness. And then the other method is go blind, completely blind. Apply the critique to everything that you encounter. In a sense, the critique is the approach, the analytical approach of the middle way. It is what Nagarjuna used to tease apart that illusion, all of those illusions. And when teased apart in his fashion, when we look through into the depths of the samsaric illusion, what remains at the bottom is what is the price of rice and luling. And that critique in the context of what we're doing here is nothing but practice. It is analysis, but it is not a rational analysis, philosophical analysis that Nagarjuna is using to defeat this illusion of reality. It's a practice approach of turning towards experience and letting that direct experience critique itself, reveal itself for what it truly is. And it may seem like those are two different methods. They're not. As practice, they are just practice. What is the great meaning of Buddha Dharma? What is the great meaning of Buddhism? The Maha great meaning, the meaning that underlies all meaning, the meaning that is reliable in all circumstances, something completely trustworthy, fundamental, universally applicable. Buddhism's response reveal what is not reliable, including Buddhism, and see what remains. Samsara is nothing other than how things appear to you, how they appear to you right now. In a sense, practice is dredging the depths of samsara. You are like this huge excavator in a quicksand pit, digging underneath itself and sinking ever deeper, emerging in New Zealand. Gazing into the heart of darkness that sometimes is dark and shadowy and slimy and filled with ghosts and pain and hurt, and which is always at the same time filled with light. When a new breath unfolds, it arrives and departs, but there are no traces. How can you look for stages on the path that cannot be seen? It's a kind of a redux with little adaptations from a poem that Keizan adds at the end of his biography in The Transmission of Light on Queen Wan, who incidentally is the seventh ancestor. So he is the person that sixth ancestor transmitted the lineage to. You know, he's the one that actually is in our lineage. It's Seigen Gyoshi, who then transmits to Sekito Kisen, out of which then we move quite quickly to Tongshan, Dogen, and the Soto lineage emerges out of. There isn't much known about him, but there's a very interesting little twist about his kind of natural giftedness and a freedom within forms that six ancestors supposedly recognize. And he's the one where the transmission was being completed. The six ancestors said, I'm not going to give you the ball and the rope. Enough with the symbols, enough with the forms. You can do without them. Go on your way and transmit what really needs to be transmitted. The robe and the ball, the lineage charts, they're a complication. They will be a complication in later days. Let's let it rest right here, right now. Which is fascinating because very, very quickly it reappears to a generation or two afterwards, if indeed this was a historical moment. How can we look for stages on a path that cannot be seen? The six stages of meditation of Juri, the fourfold foundation of mindfulness, the eightfold path, the single breath, the all-encompassing emptiness. How does that compare to what is the price of rice and luling? What is the relation of those stages to that price of rice? If there are any relations. When Queen Yuan met Huineng, he heard that Huineng was teaching at his temple, and he traveled to study with him. He traveled just for a while, and very quickly had this encounter when he came to the sixth ancestor and said, in all that I do, how can I avoid falling into the stages of spiritual development? And the six ancestors said, how do you practice? And Queen Yan said, I don't even practice the Four Noble Truths. The six ancestors said, what stages then have you fallen into? And Kuan Yin said, without even studying the Four Noble Truths, what stages could I have fallen into? He doesn't practice the Four Noble Truths, but he obviously knows about them. We negate the Four Noble Truths in the Mahaprajna Paramita Heart Sutra, but we obviously know about them. What would it mean to negate the teachings of Shantideva and his guide? What would it mean to negate the teachings of Juri, stages of meditation? What is not studying? What is not practicing? What are we doing, if anything, in that negating? What emerges in that negating as the most profound of meanings? What is the price of rice in Luling? The dredging needs to go on until everything has been dredged up. And then we see what manifests. We see what it is that we can't take apart, dredge up, get below. And that can go on for a while. And it always takes only a moment. You know, there's this, at least for me, a moment when you're canoeing in the areas in the Adirondacks where there are loons on the water. And as you approach one of them in a canoe, there's a kind of a distance that they give you, and then they dive and they disappear. And you kind of go along, but the fact is you're actually paying attention to how long they stay down there. And there is a moment where, like, you get nervous. Will they ever come up? Will it manifest ever again? How deep does this go? Will I reemerge? What will reemerge? Bodhidharma, after his encounter with Emperor Wu, disappeared for 9 years. He just dove into that cave. Not a peep, nothing. The darkness, the vastness, the ripening within that dissolution. And then suddenly up pops the price of rice. Obviously, King Wan, well, not obviously, he was. He was an abbot and his monastery was next to the city of Luling. And he had a pretty large congregation that he obviously needed to feed. They obviously were begging, or maybe not so obviously, it's China, so who knows how it is that they were going about the business of sustainability. There were probably donors, there was probably weather, there were crops, there was a need to have rice. And the monk arrived and asked him about the most profound meaning of the Buddha Dharma. And amidst his reality, his world, amidst his deep non-practicing of the Four Noble Truths, he asked, how much does rice cost? Where are you coming from? You know, Buddhism is referred to as the middle way, and again, we have all our individual ways of interpreting that, what that middle way is, of what it points to. But Buddha, again, was very, very clear at the beginning of what it is that he was speaking about. The middle way of the Buddha Dharma is that path, is that reality which is not trapped in either being or non-being. It's neither eternalism, nothing in this world exists absolutely, nor is it nihilism, nothing perishes completely. And so the Buddha's skillful way was to continuously move people from one direction to another if they saw them drifting. So when he was facing somebody who was negating reality, he would point to karma. He would point to the imprints of emptiness and the consequentiality of every single action that you took. Okay, go ahead, deal with that as a nihilist. To those who came and pointed towards some eternal existence of something, he taught selflessness. Complete, thorough emptiness of any inherent characteristic in anything. Pure conditionality. And again, it may sound abstract, but the fact is that we're continuously dealing with that challenge in our own practice, where we seek to define ourselves one way or another, to give ourselves breathing room within some negation, sometimes to ludicrous extent, and sometimes claiming territory where there is and never will be any territory of that samsaric illusion. And the path of that middle way is the path of critique. You know, the philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote the Critique of Pure Reason, where he took a look at reason and saw what would it take, what would happen if you really critiqued it all the way to a conclusion. Well, the middle way, what practice is the critique of everything. And notice the word, though, because it's important, because in that word and in how Nagarjuna uses it philosophically, there is a profound, important pointing to how to go about using that in practice. It's critique, not criticism. Criticism has an agenda, it has an attitude, it comes out of a place where I'm attacking something. Remember what Shantideva says in that poem. That poem. Where he says, with reverence but without conceptual target, I'm pointing towards emptiness of all things. It's an exhaustive study. Study that does not leave anything outside of its scope. It assumes that there may be a platform from which you're actually going to begin this looking into the nature of your mind, like the observer, like the one who is letting go, like the one who is observing the non-attachment, like the one who is behind the discerning the evil from the good action. And then the critique is applied to that. And so the dredging continues until it's completed. And we see what is it that remains beyond existence and non-existence. We're approaching this not knowing something in advance. There is no target. And as I said, if so, we will need to dissolve that knowing. So in practice, there is no need to attack the self, the reality, the perceptions, the samsara, the stages, the emptiness. In a sense, that attack, that directed energy would be actually imbuing reality, more falseness, more illusion into those things. With reverence, but without conceptual target, when shall I reveal this truth of emptiness? So Nagarjuna does his critique. He just starts touching things, pointing to things, because he understands that inherently this is a paradox. This thing is not sustainable in the way it is. Inherently, there is already a defect within it. He doesn't have to do anything at all. Just point. Just keep looking. Just keep turning. Just keep asking questions. And the whole thing implodes upon itself. The notion of time, the notion of creator, the notion of causality, the notion of the Four Noble Truths itself, they're not sustainable because they're illusory. There is no need to dismantle what does not exist in the first place. Practice is leaning into the experience, into your experience, deeply, completely, and seeing what gives way. Practice is a critique of our experience. Practice is revelation where that critique turns into criticism. Critique is cool. It has no conceptual target. It has no desire to destroy. You know, there is a tremendous amount of trust that's necessary in this. It kind of goes back to that notion of diving into the depths, trusting that if we go all the way, if with that penetrating vision we are willing to go completely blind, what we'll need to see is already there. That's that tension of doubt and trust that is so deeply required in what it is that we're doing. Complete doubt, complete trust. It's interesting how that plays itself out, actually, in the history of Buddhism. Because after Nagarjuna presented this radical teachings, after Shantideva brought this up to life in a context of the guideposts to the Bodhisattva way of life, there were some practitioners that said, no, you have to posit something at the end of it. In a sense, the school of the Yogacara was that. Nagarjuna trusted that the only thing you have to do is take the whole thing apart. And if you take it completely apart, what needs to be seen is already there. With Yogacara, they kind of wiggled around and said, no, well, we're going to posit something that's already waiting there. Kuenyan trusts, has trusted to allow himself to fall all the way through. Beyond the stages, beyond emptiness. So when the question of the great meaning of the Buddha Dharma arises, with no hesitation, there is, what is the price of rice and luling? What cannot be negated will remain. In Genji Koan, Dogen in those opening verses brings that up to light. In that final statement when he says, the great way, the Buddha Dharma, the middle way, is beyond being and non-being. Henceforth, there is life and death. Practice and enlightenment, Buddhas, ancestors, this and that. There is the price of rice. But that's because the middle way is beyond being and non-being. Beyond existence and non-existence. Vermont is a funny state. Just came back before Sesshin started from a Sesshin that I did there with a Vermonter. So one of the things that I found out is that Vermont is... there's a quote, the clause in the Constitution that supposedly Vermont is allowed to cease from the Union if it chooses to. It's the only state that has this permission to do that. Not sure if that's true, but most Vermonters secretly are very, very proud of that fact. But I also found a couple of Vermonters, a couple of people there who are, I'm not sure how seriously, are in dialogue with some eco-terrorists. that supposedly have a little enclave in Vermont that are basically really are taking kind of a radical view on the environmental crisis and are basically saying that, you know, we're not doing things fast enough. And amidst the things that they critique, besides Obama and Gore, are Buddhists. They're saying it's like, you know, this problem with Buddhists. They're kind of lackadaisical. They're slow. Their approach is not sufficiently dynamic enough, given the nature of the problem. So, you know, it's time to blow up some generators. And, you know, I thought about it, like, you know, Shantideva is the ultimate terrorist. It's like, you know, he already planted time devices on the generators of the illusion bubbles in your being. The clock is ticking. And continuing with the ludicrous analogies, you know, it's like what he's after is like what the genetic engineers are trying to do with chickens and creating the boneless chickens, you know, so you can get like more meat per unit of weight. And in a sense, kind of our task is like that, to kind of eliminate the ossification of our being. It's kind of like that terrific episode in Twilight Zone where, you know, somebody did that. They kind of started giving people injections where it would dissolve their bones, so they would kind of be jelly-like and gravel around the ground. But like, I'm not sure what is the worst of nightmares, like not having any bones or being ossified or living an ossified life amidst infinite freedom. In a very serious way, it's hard to debate the passionate eco-terrorists, because in a sense they are right. I mean, that's what Shantideva is trying to do, to bring forth the urgency, to highlight the urgency. It's as if 700 AD he knew where this was going to lead to. That if we don't address this on a level that detailed, that continuous, that extensive, then there is just the heat of suffering burning this place up. We are not doing this fast enough, thoroughly enough, genuinely enough. And then he says and adds, make sure that if you do, don't look for any signs of confirming that you are a wise and compassionate person. That too will be getting in the way of that urgency. In the poem, Hong Chi says, the accomplishing work of great peace has no sign, so look for no signs. The family way of the peasants is most pristine, only concerned with village songs and festival drinking. How would they know about the virtues of Shan and benevolence of Yao, the great meanings of the Four Noble Truths and the teachings of emptiness? No. They got to take care of the village. They got to take care of the family. They got to take care of the global village. Our path is the way of the peasants. When rustic simplicity, appreciation of the season and a ceaseless application to what is directly in front of us, what needs to be taken care of now, and what separates us from this life, deeply grounded in what is important. No frivolousness. No frivolousness that allows you, when it's time to party all out. I had a chance once to participate in a rustic party of the peasants in the southern mountains of Poland, the Gurale, the sheep people, were living in a cottage near where the wedding was going on. That went on for a week. Basically, it ended when all the alcohol in a village was consumed. And during the party, the sheep were taken care of. Humility, respect for the earth and elements, and certain roughness on your hands that comes with physical work, keenness of vision, life emerging from the deep study of this land, this land, this global village. No, there is no need to know anything about the virtues of Buddhism, because the very texture of the Four Noble Truths are the texture of your body and mind. I once went on a ferry ride in China, in the Lake District of China, where these beautiful mountains with overhanging gardens and grottos and hidden little bays that would appear and disappear. And the boat was like one of those circle line boats that go around Manhattan, a little bit smaller, driven by an old Chinese ferryman, white hair, with a bowl of rice next to him, eating quietly. It was an amazing journey through that lake with people oohing and awing as the boat would go put, 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 put. And everybody was just excited with every single vista that appeared around the corner. At a certain point, I became curious about what it was like for him, who's been driving this boat in that place, that magical place, for 40 years. So I asked him, "What do you see on this boat?" And he said, "First, you know, I listen to the engine, to its frequency, the vibrations, so I know if there are any weeds that are catching up in the propeller. I watch carefully and study all of the wave patterns on this lake, and in it I see the history of every single boat that passed here, from the time there ever was a boat on this lake. I watch the shifting patterns and the migration of the cranes and the ducks, the traceless flight that they leave across the sky. I see the reflections of the clouds and the mountains and this water, sometimes losing sense of what is up and what is down. But mostly, I see people. I see people like you, like all those other ones on this boat right now, in this environment, seeing this magical place. And I ask myself, when is the time to ask a question? When is the time to answer? And I see how it is that when they're holding hands, how they, when they embrace themselves, that embrace tightens just slightly. When the moon rises over these mountains.
If you would like more information about Dharma Communications Media Support for Spiritual Practice, you can call us at 845-688-7993, email us at support@dharma.net, or visit our website at mro.org. Thank you for supporting our work by using the resources of Dharma Communications.